this episode of the Naturist Living Show, Naked and Afraid.
This episode of the Naturist Living Show is brought to you by Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park. At Bear Oaks, we offer traditional naturist values in a modern setting. Free your body, free your mind. www.bearoaks.ca.
Welcome, dear listener, to episode 75 of the Naturist Living Show. It's January 2015, and we're well into the seventh year of doing the show, and have one episode per month. There was a lot in December, as you may have noticed, as I was catching up, because last year was a little unpredictable in terms of keeping up with the monthly podcast. But I hope you guys enjoyed everything we're doing, and I hope you'll continue to enjoy the show. My name again is Stéphane Deschaine, and I am your host for this podcast, and I'm also the owner of Bear Oaks Family Nature's Park in beautiful East Gwillimbury, Ontario. In the previous show, I mentioned a movie by the name of The Naked Peacock, which I had ordered and that Michael Connelly had pointed me towards. And I received it over the Christmas holidays and watched it, and well, actually, I guess it was probably a little bit better than I expected. Clearly, this was a film that was meant to exploit.
I wanted to see what happens on the other side of the walls. Not just peek, but really look. Anyway, I went and I looked and listened, and maybe I learned a little. So I went back and made a film. First day in the club, and well, I'm reluctant to admit it, but I'm nervous. We'd been granted permission to film, but we also had to go along with the fashion code. And as you can see, everyone here wears a traditional one-button suit.
And you've got to imagine at the time, 1974, when it came out, you would only see a movie like this in a movie theater, and the people who might pay to see all these naked folks prancing around were probably not exactly pure in spirit in why they wanted to look. But it had to be, to pass a lot of censors in its various states and provinces, it had to be a documentary, and it certainly is that. It's actually better than I expected. The clip from YouTube, which I provided a link to in the last show, and I'll provide again, was definitely the exploitive part, which was the beauty contest at the Miss Nude contest at the Four Seasons Nudist Resort in Ontario. But the rest of the movie has a decent balance of gender, but definitely more women. I wouldn't say it's good balance of age. It's certainly mostly younger men and women, unless that's the way it was in those clubs they visited. Perhaps it was. But there's still lots of things which, you know, suggest that the intentions of the producers and the editors were less than pure. There's a lot of lingering and close-ups on breasts and genitals in general, mostly of women. There's a few dreamy segments where a young woman is walking in the field or riding a horse with nothing but music as she beautifully prances through the field. But, you know, most of the movie, frankly, is scenes you would expect to see. There's a skydiving scene that's a little different. Other than that, it's people swimming, lots of kids in the movie, which is nice. It does show families. Body painting, meditation, exercise. A fair bit of it seems to have been done at Elysium, and they had a number of different workshops which were filmed. Elysium took the naturist movement to a whole different angle. Some people were critical about certain things that were done there. Others thought it was very avant-garde and interesting. There's certainly a lot of books came out of that. Some certainly are very sexual in nature. They go on a sailboat ride, they dance, there's a nude wedding, a luau, an art show. But really, the part that just still really gets me is the that beauty contest of the Four Seasons. I love this part.
The judges wore clothing so as not to show favoritism.
I mean, why does being clothed make you more objective? And I think it just makes you into a voyeur. And certainly, as I mentioned before, the hosts, everybody was dressed except a lot of the audience, and certainly the contestants who were there for the pleasure, the viewing pleasure of the audience and their photography equipment, which they all seemed to have. So anyway, it was still interesting. I enjoy the history. You learn a little bit about how things were viewed by the outside world and what naturism, I guess, was supposed to be in some ways, at least through the words on the movie. But speaking of the beauty contest, that last show where I talked about that and played the segment from YouTube really seemed to get to Felicity in terms of inspiring her to write one of her blogs. Hi, Felicity.
Hey, Stefan.
So that was, I really appreciate the fact you're writing these really in-depth articles attached to the podcasts, and the one about the beauty pageant you just did, there was a lot of research in that. That was good.
Yeah, I did some research. I was just really curious. You know, by the time I grew up at a club that actually never did any beauty pageants, and even by the time I grew up, like, they were kind of not the popular thing anymore as much. So I was curious just how nudists back then kind of viewed the pageants and why they were a big thing, and what naturist mentality was back then also.
And so what did you discover for those who haven't read the blog that you did?
Well, basically, there were some clubs in Canada and clubs in the United States that were both doing pageants that were like an internal thing within the clubs. And they were having kind of these cutesy little pageants, I think, where any nudist who was a member of the club could enter it. And they would have a contest based on the person's contribution to nudism and how tan they were, because that was like a demonstration of how committed they were to nudism if they had this great all-over tan and that sort of thing. And then their personality, and it wasn't just like a beauty thing. And then there's the Miss Nude World, which is a whole different animal.
Yes, well, and you know, we heard from the Steins how they knew what they were doing. They knew it was exploitive, and you have the same thing at the Ponderosa in Indiana, that, you know, one day a year or one weekend a year, the place is no longer a family nudist park, as they say. It's a weekend of nude debauchery and voyeurism and exhibitionism and stuff. So, which makes a lot of money, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it's profitable. I mean, that was a sort of goal with some of the pageants in the 60s and 70s. The clubs were doing these events to get a little publicity, because a lot of times the local newspaper or something would write an article about it and give them a little bit of press. And obviously Miss Nude World was a very profitable and successful event at the Four Seasons. But you know, I wanted to know how, because the difference between the Ponderosa, Nudes of Poppin' thing, that's like a separate thing. I mean, maybe some of the members go to it, but it's not like a thing by and for nudists, per se. And this was something that, you know, nudists openly condoned and organized and participated in. And I was like, well, was it controversial back then? You know, did anybody sit there and say, wait a minute. Maybe this isn't nudism for putting, like, pretty naked women on stage or, you know, bringing in reporters to come take picture of the girl who won most attractive girl in this contest. And I did find a little bit of evidence that some club owners were kind of conflicted about it, or, you know, some nudists were even against it. But this one book I was reading, it was quoting the owner of that other club in Canada. I forget what it's called. Their competitor.
Well, there's the Ponderosa. There's Four Seasons in the Ponderosa. We're right across.
Not Ponderosa. The club that they first discovered, I think, when they moved in.
Sun Valley Gardens, probably.
Yes, Sun Valley Gardens. Yeah, the owner of Sun Valley Gardens was, like, quoted saying that there were other clubs who were doing exploitative things, and I'm sure he was talking about the Four Seasons.
So what's your thought? Does the end justify the means? Because it certainly promoted some, you know, some people say, well, it was very effective in promoting naturism or nudism and getting more people to try it and made money.
Yeah. I think my conclusion is that we can forgive the little nudist pageants that were held at the clubs that were just not like public events. Those were just, you know, their own little contests. And I feel like those are okay. You know, those we can forgive. But the Miss Nude World, it's like, nah. It would have been a little better, you know, if nudists weren't like, let's just forget our ideals because this thing right here, and this is going to get us a lot of money and a lot of publicity, and it's going to get everybody talking about nudism. And, well, who cares if it's exploiting, you know, if it's exploitation and just playing into the culture, the dominant culture of women are just pretty objects for us to look at kind of thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm always using the vegetarian example, and it, to me, like, this is like vegetarians promoting their cause by having a hamburger sale.
Yeah.
It probably sells, you know, you can sell a lot of hamburgers, but how do you justify what you're doing then? But I agree with you. The smaller ones or the ones inside the clubs, you know, when you're in the beginning of the naturist and nudist movement, it was a lot about achieving the ideal body, and it was a whole health ideal body culture, not just in naturism and nudism, particularly in Europe, but there was, you know, a physical fitness during the 30s, and they thought that, you know, because of evolution, you had to encourage people to procreate who are the best, a sort of eugenics kind of concept. So,
and right.
not that that's right, but that was the culture at the time. And so to encourage people to be the most beautiful they could be, you can see how the beauty contest kind of fits into that.
Yeah, I totally get that. I came across that to that same conclusion just reading old nudist magazines, because they have just the sort of articles they'd have. And then this one magazine just had like a spread of these really chiseled men, and they were even wearing underwear for some reason, but it was, let's admire these really chiseled, healthy, toned physiques, because this is like the healthiest, most fit body for us to aspire to.
Right. So that was just a movement, and, you know, we now know that that's not how we move forward as a species anymore, but that's what they thought back then. But that doesn't excuse all this exploitation, especially by the time you get to the 60s and 70s. We knew better at that point.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that today that everyone would be against it if, like, some naturist decided to put on a beauty pageant.
Yeah.
I feel like some naturists would just be like, oh, okay, that sounds fun.
Yeah, well, you know, like I keep saying, we have all these recreational naturists. They don't really understand why they like it. It just feels good. And there's nothing really wrong with that. And everybody has to get all intellectual about what we do.
I guess. I mean, I get a little annoyed because there have been some comments on my post where it's like, well, if I go to the nudist club, I want to look at healthy bodies. I don't want to look at, I mean, I don't want to see really overweight people. You know, it's better if we're healthy.
Yeah, well, so they're going to look. They're not going to be naturists. They're going for a show. So
yeah,
and that's what's wrong.
Yeah, I mean it's very annoying that we still, just as a society in general, that not to get too off topic, but it's like we have this whole thing of if you're thin, then you must be healthy, and you're therefore beautiful.
Right.
And if you're fat, well, you're ugly, and you're not healthy at all.
Yeah, and even if you take away the whole extremes of, you know, undereating or overeating or being really overweight, there's still huge differences in body types, and
right.
You know that it doesn't take that into account, that we're a very varied species even when we are healthy. There's no one ideal look, but that was then.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think now naturism, we need to do a better job at being more body positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, the problem, I think most of the biggest problem is what we talk about. It's not those little beauty pageants which don't exist anymore. It's the exploitation which still exists today. You still have the nudes a popping show, and you still get people doing websites that are totally exploiting us and selling, peddling flesh and selling our bodies as if, you know, as objects. And by the way, I got I didn't get Mondo Nudes still yet, but I got the one that Michael sent me, which was the Naked Peacock, and it is exactly what I expected. Wow, I can just, you know, before videos, before people could watch porn on the internet, this is what people paid in these little corner movie theaters to go and drool over. And I was getting kind of the creeps just thinking about it as I was watching.
Oh, my God. I mean, just that YouTube clip was so creepy. I was like, let's sit back and watch the show. And it's just like, oh, and yeah, naked parade of women. Like, oh, my God.
And, of course, and the people in the background are wearing a tuxedo and a you know, fancy ball gown.
Right.
And all these other people trying to take pictures at the same time.
Yeah, and then you have this obvious, like, crowd of the naked – I'm not naked. You have the clothed male judges. And
yes.
the white male dress photographer is like ogling and taking pictures.
Yeah, my favorite part is when they say that the judges remain clothed so as to not show them impartiality. Like,
yeah.
How does that work? What are they getting at there?
Yeah.
Well,
that was funny.
It was. So. Well, we're not doing that. You're not doing that, right? So at least, and we'll keep fighting against it. We'll keep highlighting it and telling people. Hopefully most people get it.
Yeah, I hope so. Exactly.
Do you have any body positive events or things happening?
Well, right now we're actually working on the next New York City Body Painting Day for this summer.
Oh, excellent. How was last year? Did last year's work out really well?
Yeah, it was amazing. It came out in newspapers like all over the world. Got so much media coverage, and it was just overall a very successful event. And now, for this summer, we want to double it in size. So we want to have 50 artists and like 100 models.
Wow!
And Andy, the main artist who's been putting all this together, he also is working on an event for Amsterdam.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so, but in order to do this, we need money. We need to be able to fund it. So we're actually launching a Kickstarter, and by the time this podcast goes live, that will be online, should be. So people should check out the Kickstarter and give if they can support us. That would be awesome.
Good. Well, we'll put the link in the show notes. And, of course, you'll have a link from yna.me, right?
Yes.
Excellent. So we'll look for it.
Yes. Please do. And hopefully more people can come and participate.
On the subject of old movies, Michael Connelly again found an old Australian TV show about the evolution of the bathing suit, which makes it seem like it was perfectly normal that nobody would be wearing bathing suits anymore by the 1980s. He found it through the All Nudist blog, which has lots of interesting stuff, and I'll provide a link to that. And the TV show is something that he wanted to talk about.
Hi, and welcome to the second episode of Aussie Nudie News. I'm Michael Connolly, a.k.a. Nudie Man, and in this episode I wish to talk to you about the history of nudism in Australia. Recently, a TV documentary surfaced on YouTube, and it was posted on Facebook by allnudist.com. The program originally went to air in 1985. It is called From Neck to Knee to Nude, and it's all about the history of bathing in Australia. And it documented the swimwear styles and fashions from the First Fleet, when it was often common for men to swim naked in Sydney Cove. And then it traces right through all the years, with bathing suits starting out covering everything, then up through the 60s, 70s and 80s, with the explosion of the bikini, with more and more skin being revealed. They even touched on topless equality.
Like most of the innovations on Australian beaches, it came about by civil disobedience. Women removed their bikini tops to sunbathe, and beach inspectors told them to cover up.
Everyone does it. All young people do it. You wear a dress and it shows your straps. It's not only from a vain point of view. If a man can do it, why can't a woman do it?
Most people that come down here bathe topless, and most beaches are topless, so what are they going to do? Arrest everybody.
Then on to the then present day of 1985, where nudity was portrayed as being the norm.
What to wear to the beach? It's a question Australians have been asking for almost 200 years. Today, we have family beaches, topless beaches, and nude beaches. We've come a long way from when bathing in public was banned between sunrise and sunset.
Now, the young lady you just listened to is totally naked, and there is absolutely no censorship of any kind. In other parts of the video, in the background, you can also see naked family groups frolicking on nude beaches, etc. Let's have a listen to some more.
It's come full circle. By the 1980s, nude bathing is now common on a lot of beaches around Australia. Most of the changes in costume have really been won by civil disobedience. Today, Australians can choose what kind of costume they want to wear on the beach, and at a number of beaches they can choose, if they so desire, not to wear any costume at all.
By the way they're talking in this video, it sounds like a nude utopia. Quick, someone build me a time machine. Yeah, I should mention that around this time in Australia, full frontal nudity on TV was very common after 8:30 p.m. And this documentary is no exception. It's full of nudity, all uncensored. And the hostess is just reclining on the beach and calmly talking to the camera, and there was absolutely no blurring or anything. Now, I was about 19 in 1985, and I clearly remember the prevalence of full frontal nudity on television. And then even when I was younger, around 10 or so, my parents, you know, never stopped me watching anything. And it was quite common to see nudity on television all the time. And we also had a topless page 3 girl in the daily newspaper. Flash forward to 2015, we've almost gone backwards. But why? Well, it's a number of factors, I feel. Body image, people just don't want to be seen naked. The anti-sun message, people are scared of the sun. Influences from overseas TV censorship. Just about every show you see out of America has got some sort of blurring. And we have the fashion industry, of course, and then modern technology such as smartphones. And all these factors scare people off public nudity. Then you also got the various family and children's first lobby groups. Don't forget about the children. What about the children? All this is just trying to curtail nudity on TV. And not forgetting we also live in a multicultural society with various religions frowning on nudity. So no wonder they don't want to show too much skin on TV after 8:30. But having said that, we still show more nudity than American TV. It's still common to see bare breasts on television late at night. Case in point is a true story crime drama called Underbelly. Guess what? It's not non-sexual nudity. The actresses are usually engaged in some sort of sex act. So what's the answer? Well, some things are slowly coming full circle. The body image movement in Australia, for example. Taryn Brumfitt, a mother of three from South Australia, who was fed up for being ashamed of her body, she's now touring the world showing women that they can love their naked bodies. She discovered the Sydney Skinny last year and found out how liberating it was to swim naked with other people. Hello! That's what we nudies have been saying for years. In regards to SunSafe message, well, slowly health organisations around the world are waking up to the fact that the big, bad, evil sun causes cancer message has been way too successful. And now everyone's living under a rock and not getting enough vitamin D. And in Australia, they've even started advocating people to get some regular sunshine. They've even got a D-Day to get some more vitamin D from the sun. Once again, the nudies have been saying the same thing about the sun. And it happens to be one of my passions, safe sun exposure. I wrote a article on my website, Sensible Tanning, so you have to check that out. Anyway, eventually, and hopefully, if I'm still around to see it, society will come full circle again and relax about nudity. Well, I'm dreaming. But hey, you got to have a dream. Anyway, that's about it for my Aussie news today. Hope you've enjoyed the show. There'll be links in the show notes to items mentioned. So until next time, stay nude. Oh, except if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. By the way, I've done this podcast from the top of a mountain today. I'm out in the sun. It's around about 20 degrees here, about 8:30 in the morning. And I'm about to go for a nude hike. Have a good one.
Also in the last show, I read a review of Naked and Afraid by Michael. I don't know if Michael wants me to use his last name, so I won't. But as a result of my reading that review and saying that I had been trying to get in touch with producers, Michael Conley, again, Michael, you're getting mentioned in this show an awful lot these days, put me in touch with Manu Toigo, who is one of the contestants in the first season of Naked and Afraid.
On this special edition of Naked and Afraid,
we're in a survival situation.
Two couples.
Look up! Unbelievable. Ah!
All experienced survivalists.
There's not too many things that can break me.
Put their skills to the ultimate test.
I feel like I've been working really hard.
Oh, get out of here!
They have no water, no food, and no clothes.
It's a whole different situation and we're naked.
Their challenge to survive for 21 days.
We need to get out now.
Knowing that the human body can only survive for 3 days without water and begins to shut down after 3 weeks without food.
Son of a bitch!
This is the Everest of survival challenges.
Those things could probably rip your face off.
Get!
But in the harshest environment yet.
Welcome, Panama. Now I hear you say, I don't deserve to be here.
I didn't come here to get bashed on by people.
Where two people could easily fail.
It is flooded.
Can four strangers find a way to survive and thrive together, naked and afraid?
Oh my God!
I hate this damn swamp.
6 miles to the east, another pair of survivalists are headed to a separate insertion point deep inside a forbidding mangrove swamp.
My name is Mane Toigo. I work in Los Angeles and I do executive protection. I also do training with the special forces. I'm the type of person that likes to face extreme challenges. By doing this, I hope that I can prove to myself once again, there's not too many things that can break me.
It's like this little hint of adrenaline rushing through me because I just can't wait to get in there and do something.
How are you? I mean, you went through a very scary bout with dengue fever there, and you couldn't walk for a while. How are you now?
Surprisingly and amazingly, and I'm certainly blessed, I'm doing extremely well. I'm not going to say that I have recovered 100% simply because of all the nerve. Mainly it's the nerve damage that was caused by it. So basically I have the aftermath of what it would feel like, the nerves still trying to come back.
Mm.
It's not debilitating by any means.
Yeah.
But for months there, because of the damage to the nerves and so on, I was experiencing massive spasms throughout my body that were just excruciating. And this went on for months after I had contracted the virus and while I was doing physical therapy. I was in physical therapy for 8 months, 2 to 3 times a week.
Wow.
Yes.
And so, and because you live in the U.S., of course, medical expenses are not covered by government, unlike in Canada. So did the show pay for that, or did you have other ways to cover your costs?
Well, that's a very interesting story. As a matter of fact, I think TV Guide read up an article in reference to what this all detains. Basically, the insurance that we're covered by is only covered while we are in the other country, while we are actually surviving for the 21 days. What happened to me, even though I was bit in the jungle and contracted the hemorrhagic dengue virus, the full effects of it didn't actually occur until like 3 days after I'd gotten back in the US. So there has been lots of, how would you say, controversial goings on with regards to the insurance and how my medical bills are being paid. Now, they're not making me take full responsibility of that. However, it's still scary for me because I'm seeing those bills come up my doorstep, and I can say we're over $250,000 now in medical bills, and they are still being paid off. I'm still receiving those bills.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's for the listeners who are in European countries or in Canada or places like that. That's that's a scary thought because we're used to the fact that when we're sick, we're covered, but you have to find a way of paying it yourself.
Well, likewise, living up in Australia, we don't have any concerns about our health care and how we're going to pay for it and so on. Here, it's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. And that mentioning of over $250,000, I'm not even including the physical therapy. So you can imagine how much that added up to after 8 months of physical therapy.
Oh, absolutely. So do you regret having done the show?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, you can't go through when something drastic happens to you or life-threatening, why would you have regrets? Because ultimately, you're learning from that. It's building you a strength and from an experience.
Right.
And, anything that comes at me thereafter, and this is not just the hemorrhagic dengue or surviving in the jungle for 21 days. This is all the other things that I've done in my life that from those experiences, it prepares me for every day that is coming to me.
Hmm. So let's talk about how you ended up on the show, because you were on the last show of the very first episode. So I'm guessing that when you first signed up for this, you didn't know anything about the show. It had never been on air yet. You were blind, essentially. Is that right?
Actually, it had been airing. Now, I don't have a TV. I don't watch TV because I think it puts a lot of shit in your head that you don't really need to, you don't want to be doused with. And I heard about it when I was working on a film set. And the camera guy said, you should be on Naked and Afraid. And he went on to explain to me what it was. And it was his son that was actually a videographer for that, a camera guy for the show. And I said, oh, wow, that sounds really right up my alley. And so I pursued it. And within, a couple of months, few months, I was doing the show. Now, originally, my show was its intention was to be the season premiere for season two. They ended up tagging us as the finale for season one because they weren't getting survivors that were staying past day three. A lot of them were dropping out day one. So as I recall, there were approximately 13 survivalists that started it and did not even pass day three.
Oh, and they never put those on the show then.
What's the point?
Right.
What can they do?
Yeah.
So what they ended up doing as to rescue the whole thing, they tagged us as the finale, and then they brought back Laura Zera, which is she's an amazing girl. I know her in person, and she's an incredible lady and very fun, very bubbly and fun. And that's what makes her so amazing for the show, because of her personality. And EJ. EJ had previously done an African one, and Laura, she was on a beach. So they ended up in the rainforest down in the Amazon. So that was very extreme opposites from what they experienced before, compared to their first episodes that they did.
So the you had mentioned people, a lot of people didn't make it.
Right.
So this, just for people, there's a lot of cynics out there. This is real, right? There is no, you are not getting any help when you're out there. What we see on TV
not at all. Too much. You know, the show Survivor, that's been around for a long time now. The show Survivor is based on survival, and they have to do all sorts of things. But they make it look like they're doing everything on their own, feeding themselves, hunting, and all that kind of stuff. But because that particular show is competition-based, and they're having to compete physically, emotionally, all that together, they have to be fed a minimum amount of calories just to get through every single day.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are thinking that Naked and Afraid is on a similar basis. Everyone thinks that there's a nice tent somewhere close by where they all hang out and eat great food, and we get a bit of food and we get water and everything like that. Absolutely not. This show is skeleton crew, one camera guy, one sound guy, one producer. They come in from wherever the heck they come in from. we don't even know where they are. And in my case, they were on a whole different island in comparison to where I was. I was in the jungle, Russell and I, and they were on some private island that they were at. And then sometime in the afternoon, they would disappear. And then we were completely on our own. Now, the only thing that I will say is they did have a medic tent somewhere in around our vicinity where we had a safety radio. So if something was to happen, we could radio the medic. And then the medic had a satellite phone to connect with outside sources.
Right.
So that's how extreme it is. We do not get a single help from any of them. And we're not even the only time we talk to them is, of course, when they pull us aside and they do that those little interview snippets.
So if there's – do they check – like what if you got very dehydrated or something and didn't realize it? Is there a point where they would say, okay, that's enough? Is that what happens to the people who don't make it?
I am pretty sure that there has been at least one case where one of the girls went into severe dehydration and they had to give her IV for fluids.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know who that was, where that was, or what episode that was, but I am aware that that has happened. EJ that went to Africa, he had gotten a thorn in his foot and he didn't remove the whole thorn completely, so it remained inside his foot and it became septic.
Oh.
So they had to take him out in, you know, like race him back to the medic tent. And we're not going to a hospital either, we're just going to a medic tent where these medics from, you know, locals they are. You know, they had to do a bit of surgery on his foot and then they go back out. They are given the choice. Do you want to finish? Do you want to quit? You know, but EJ decided to stay. I don't know about the other young lady. But if it's in dire strait where it is absolutely life-threatening, yes, they do step in, and it's only for medical needs. When it comes to hunger, they do not help. They're not handing you any kind of sandwich or biscuits to get you through or anything like that. And, you know, in Panama, it rained every single day. So it's not necessarily we were without water. We were just without a lot of resources to catch that water to be able to drink it. But I came up with some ingenious creative ideas in order to get that water just from the rain, which was delicious.
Oh, that's good. I was contacted by the producers at one point to see if I wanted to be on the show. And I didn't know anything about the show. It was in the first season as well. So I went to look at it and I said, okay, yes, I am very comfortable without clothes on, but I don't think that should be I don't think that's an important criteria here. After having watched the show, the nudity doesn't seem like a big deal. Was it an issue at all for you, the nudity?
Well, personally, no. I mean, I grew up on a sugarcane farm where I was just running around in a pair of knickers until I was 12 years old. So, you know, having a naked body doesn't faze me at all. I mean, I love being naked. That's why I don't like winter so much, because I have to put clothes on.
Yes.
But what it does do, being naked in survival environments, when you think about it, it's your first line of defense against the elements. Mm-hmm. And when you take it away, in particular your shoes, you become so exposed to the elements that you go into. Oh my gosh, it just didn't seem. I was always I'm very sensitive to the cold, so I was feeling hypothermic almost every single night that I was there in the jungle. I don't remember being comfortable at all.
Wow.
Anytime at night, because of the rain, because of the cold, you've got no clothing. Our feet, oh my goodness. I think every survivalist who does this show, their biggest thorn in the side is not having shoes. I mean, our feet are just loaded with all the nerves and become very, very sensitive and damaged from walking around in different types of environments.
Yes, I guess it's because we don't practice it. You know, if we lived our lives like some people, you know, some people still live without shoes most of the time, but very few of us do. If you did, I bet you would build a nice thick callous sole and it wouldn't bother you. But
I had that when I was growing up on the farm. It was like even my father's feet, my brother's feet, they're mm-hmm. all like tires on the bottom of their feet. And then, I mean, I grew up not wearing any shoes, and I remember trekking through the farm, running on a gravel road, you know, walking on bitumen. So it wasn't until, you know, I really had done this, and I love to go barefoot as much as I can anyways. I'm not one of these people that wear shoes all the time. I'll go barefoot whenever I can. Even 2 weeks before I did the show, I went barefoot everywhere. I walked up in the park. I walked throughout LA to try and toughen up my feet, and even 2 weeks just did not make a difference at all. It became quite crippling. Where we were, there was a lot of volcanic rock. So you can imagine trying to walk on volcanic rock.
Wow, yeah. All
day, every day. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make for a pleasant, pleasant day. You're just like, oh, oh, oh. I mean, just trying to collect wood, just trying to walk around, get food. You know, it's just like your feet. That's all you can think about is your feet. I'm in so much pain.
Well, the nudity, though, seems to be more of an issue for some. It didn't seem to be for your partner, Russell, but in your show, for those who haven't seen it, you ended up meeting up with another couple, and Casey, it was quite amusing to see that occasionally she had fashioned a little, you know, bikini bottom and a bra out of, and you think, wow, that would be a lot of time and energy spent for something that seems completely useless and probably uncomfortable.
Well, the funny thing is, I remember the producer asking me, so, you know, are you going to try and make some clothing? And I said to her, I said, look around. Do you really see anything around you that I can actually work with to try and make some clothing? I'm not going to put in that effort. I there are way more important things for me to do than think about clothing. And the reason why they ask you to attempt to make some clothing, because it makes it easier on the editing guys, you know, like for the blurring out and so on. So a lot of the times it's not necessarily because they're trying to be a little bit more modest. It's more about we're being kindly asked if we could divvy up some sort of clothing to help out the editing to avoid as much blurring as possible. But, I mean, where I was, there was just nothing around. It's not like I was on a bloody beach where where I could collect a whole bunch of grass or, you know, nice good leaf or something like that. And there was a palm in the jungle there that had Hessian-like stuff. If you look at palm trees, in between each palm thing, there's a thin Hessian that is in between all the branches.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was building the shelter, I was collecting all that Hessian. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, yeah, I could make clothing at this, but what's more important, dry materials to make a fire? So I did occasionally, quite often, have the Hessian wrapped around my chest or around my waist. But as soon as it dried out, what's more important? Russell and I was like, let's try and get this fire going despite the rain. So that's what I was. I was just using my body heat to try and dry it out, those materials, so we can try and get a fire going, which was very, very difficult. Tell me, in the first week that Russell and I were there, I can tell you we attempted probably 16 to 18 times to get fire going. Yeah, that's how difficult it was.
Neither of you had a fire starter?
Oh, no, we had a fire starter.
Ah.
It was the fact that it was just so wet down there, and Russell and I were in the swamps. So when it rained, those swamps just filled up with water, and everything was just wet.
Right, yeah. Each person gets to bring one item, and it's. I see often that one person brings a machete and the other one brings a fire starter, but it's not like you get to talk to each other, right, before?
No, we don't even see each other. We don't talk to each other. What they do is they ask us to choose or bring along with us to wherever we're going four items. When we get there, we hand them over. So it's the producers or whoever it is that decides who gets what tool.
Oh, okay. So that's why you never end up with two people with machetes and no fire starter.
Correct. Yes.
Good.
That's why. Yeah. I mean, you know, it makes total sense. And then, of course, you know, why would you bring, you know, a small survival knife to a jungle when you really do need a machete? You know, so it all depends on where you are going. They do tell us where we're going. So I did choose items that I knew were going to benefit me in the jungle. One guy, I heard a rumor, and this is a rumor. I don't know if it's absolutely true, but one guy actually brought a roll of duct tape, which to me is actually very ingenious because you can do a lot of things
with
duct tape. You can make bowls, you can make shoes, you can build a shelter. There's so many things you can do with duct tape. And they wouldn't let him use it because it was too much of an advantage.
Huh, interesting. Interesting. So how did they select you? What did you have to prove to that you knew what to do, that you were a survivalist?
Even that is even that one is a little baffling. Now, I do consider myself a survivalist. I have done survival before. I've done, you know, a couple of weeks up in the Colorado Mountains. I did a show with Discovery before called I, Caveman, and this was all the indigenous caveman kind of style survival.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened, and then, I've been out in the woods many times in my life, even growing up. So basically they kind of ask you questions. They have a guy that interviews you, talks about survival, ask you what you would do in certain situations. How would you do this? How do you find water? And so on. But the actual physical ability to survive is completely different from textbook survival.
Sure.
And you look at someone like me or Russell, we have actual dirt time, as they call it, like experience in the field of putting all your knowledge into practical use and developing your skills. But there have been a lot of people, including the young lady that was with me, it was all textbook. She may have watched videos or read a survival book. Who knows? I don't know. But she had no physical experience whatsoever. And it just goes to show, it's just like, you can call yourself a survivalist, but do you have the practicality and the physical ability to put all that into use? Because every place you go is going to be different. The environment's going to be different. Your tactic's going to be different. So you need to be extremely creative with how you use your surroundings and how you assess your surroundings in order to survive. And it's not just that. It's what your body goes through. Day three comes along without food, without enough water. Your body's going into shock. It's going into a whole different survival mode, and you feel it. Anyone who's done those cleansing things, you know, the 7-day, yep, or 9-day cleansing things, and all they're drinking is, what is it, lemon water with cayenne pepper or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Right? There's always that note, day three, day four, sometimes day five, your body's going into massive change. It's getting rid of all the toxic garbage that your body holds, and you just end up with extreme headaches, and it's a horrible, horrible feeling. So for someone who's not experienced that, that's when it can really test your mental strength.
So do you have any idea how they select your partner? You and Russell seem relatively well suited for each other. You worked well together. You both had very similar experiences.
Yeah, actually, I think we're the only couple that got along together and worked together as a team. He supported me and I supported him. No matter what happened, how we were feeling or anything, we were very well suited. And I think that right at the beginning, we said to each other, we made a promise to each other that we would have each other's back. When we met and we did the hug, and we're the first couple that actually joined together and hugged completely naked, not knowing each other, right? The first thing that I said, we will have each other's back, and until we're done.
Yes.
So it makes a difference where your mind is right from the beginning. Throughout, like with, in the first week, particularly day two, day three is typically where you see the tempers start coming in because your body's going through change and you're going a little crazy up in your head. That's when you start getting a little feisty, so to speak, towards your partner. And I think the producers did not expect Russell and I to get along so well. When you look at the other survivors and how they dealt with each other. And there were some really rough spots, you know, like she's this, she's that. And she would be saying, he's this, he's that. No, Russell and I, we did not have a bad or negative thing to say about each other at all throughout the whole thing.
Do you think that that's disappointing for the producers because it doesn't add that level of intrigue?
I don't know. I don't think it was disappointing. You know, I mean, at first, I guess that's what they were used to, you know, like having this little offsets and so on, little drama, because that's what television is all about. People want to see the drama.
Yes.
And there was no drama between Russell and I. It wasn't until we met up with Cassie and Forrest, towards Forrest, but it was Cassie that created quite a little drama between all of us.
Yes, well, she did not seem to be as well suited for the survival part. On her own, she may not have made it 21 days.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And she knows it. She knows it. We actually met up a couple of weeks ago, since the show. So, and we talked about a lot of things. And we talked about, you know, what we were talking about on the rock when I had that long conversation with her in the jungle. And she says, yeah, I don't think I could do it again. I think she realized that she bit off more than she could eat.
So do you think the naked part, do you think there's value in that, or do you think that's just an attempt by Discovery Channel to get people to pay attention? Because whenever you say the word naked, you know, everybody pays attention.
You pay attention. Yes, I think so. I believe so. But remember, you know, these people don't really know a lot about survival, I think. And at first, you know, being naked was to get attention. And it certainly did. But then what it did develop into, it really pushes you past your comfort zones because you're so exposed. So it actually becomes an added difficulty to attempting this. It's not just about it's become more than just like the name being thrown out there. It's becoming like, okay, you may be able to survive in clothes and the comfort of your clothes, the warmth of your clothes, but can you survive without it?
Yes, did your perception of your nudity change over 21 days? Did it mean something different? Did you feel any different?
It's quite liberating, actually. It is quite liberating. Now, I mean, maybe that question should go to someone who's been clothed all their lives. I mean, I grew up on a farm. I was running around butt naked for a lot of years. So nudity to me wasn't it wasn't foreign. It wasn't abnormal. I mean, I used to see my mother just walk around in a pair of knickers around the farmhouse, you know? So I guess my thinking is probably very different compared to, you know, most of the other survivalists. Because Americans, they grow up, even when they're babies, they're putting shoes on their feet, you know, walking around in shoes. I'm not sure. You might want to throw that question out to someone who's a little bit more prudish or modest.
Did you feel that it was an issue for Russell at all?
Oh, no. He was funny. He'd be like, hell no, I'm not trying to put on no damn clothes. It's like, I want to be free. this is my only chance in life to be free in the middle of the jungle. So he was not at all interested in trying to cover up. he thoroughly enjoyed being naked.
Throughout this experience, you know, truly being nude, being your true natural self in a traditional natural environment, did you ever think about, you know, your relationship to our ancestors 100,000 years ago?
Yes. You could say I did. Many times I was there, and this is like, how primal can you get? This is the most incredible feeling and experience, and you were just in that moment many, many times in that moment. This is like, I am truly, truly back to nature, how we were born, how thousands and thousands of years ago we were meant to be, the Adam and Eve.
Did you find, so you were without any support from any modern technology or devices or anything, no clothes, nothing. How did you find your body was suited for living in the natural world?
Oh, there is one thing that I will say. Since I've been back, all I've wanted, all I've been wanting and thinking about is finding my own piece of property and then just living back to nature on that property, building from scratch, being self-sustainable, getting away from modern society, getting back to our natural roots, doing my own growing, my own trapping, hunting, things like that. It's kind of like a realization that I want to get back to where I'm meant to be, where I'm most comfortable at. I'm still having a little difficulty, I can honestly say, living in Los Angeles. I mean, granted, I'm living in Los Angeles, so it's not like I'm going back to a small rural town or, you know, where some of these other people are from. I'm actually back in the city of the dirt and grime and the noise. And I have been finding it very difficult. And there's this website that I keep looking at every single day, just waiting for that ultimate opportunity if the price is right and the location is right for those little tiny houses on a piece of land. And that's where I'm gonna end up. I am not content anymore living here in Los Angeles in the city.
Well, what are you doing now that this is done? What are you doing for a living?
Well, as everyone knows, I was doing bodyguard stuff and, you know, private security. And I was also, I had been part of a special operations training group down in San Diego where we did like military, like Navy SEAL buds training for executive corporations and so on. So, you know, it wasn't actual special operations. They just like to throw that word around. But I've really, even since the show, it was a wake-up call for me. It's like, what am I doing? Why am I getting myself involved in a negative part of it's not working towards peace. It's not working towards humanity or anything like that. So I stepped out and I started working with a company that works with the Los Angeles school districts. And they have the after-school programs and weekend programs and all sorts. So I've been taking kids out on outdoor adventures like kayaking, rock climbing, rappelling, scuba diving, snorkeling, biking, hiking, backpacking. And I absolutely love it. And I've been attached to a school just north of here. It's a military school for elementary and high school. And I go up there once a week and teach survival class. And that's what I do. And believe me, the power and the, oh my gosh, that feeling of doing something that is worth that has its worth more than words can describe, working with these kids. And I just love it because they are our future. And it's a thrill to me, being my age, running around doing all this crazy stuff with these young kids.
It sounds like the show changed you in many ways for the good. Is that why you did it? Did you know it would have this impact? People often will say, why would anybody put themselves through this?
Yeah, true. I mean, if someone asked me that, I was just like, well, I don't know. I mean, to me, I'm always looking for a challenge. I'm looking for something that is going to make me grow, have a new experience, see how far I can push myself. Always testing myself to see what I can do, wanting to learn new skills, new adventures. I don't become very content easily, it certainly did change me unexpectedly, in a sense of I had no idea in my future, before the show or even during the show or even just after the show when I was sick, that I was going to be doing this, that I was going to be working with the kids. That has really changed my life. It's not about me changing their lives and giving them experience. Yes, I'm doing that. But the kids themselves are changing me and giving me an experience. And I'm learning from them. And it's just an amazing feeling. I love it. Those kids are amazing.
And just for the record, you don't get paid a ton of fortune for surviving. They don't talk about any money or anything like that, right?
No. No.
You didn't do it for the money.
No, did it for the love of it and the experience. It's like, all right, I'm in it. Let's do it.
So I got in contact with you because of Michael Connelly in Australia as well, and he's hoping to do it. So for anyone who might be interested, what would your advice be to them?
Have a very creative mind. Know that it's going to be extremely uncomfortable, but have dirt time. Get to know how your body is going to operate in the field. You need that experience. You do. You need dirt time. You need to be out there and recognize how uncomfortable it can be. Particularly, a lot of people go camping. And a lot of people think that going camping is like really roughing it, but they take their tent and their sleeping bag and their cushions and their pillow and everything, including the kitchen sink. that's the difference. So going out camping is certainly not going out testing what it's going to be like, actual surviving. So you really do need that. Even these survival schools, I've been asked, what survival school did you go to learn all this? And I said, I've not been to a survival school, nor would I. I'd probably step in for a day or two, to learn a new skill perhaps, but it's not really going to teach you actual survival. Because most of the survival schools, they're in a particular area, so therefore they're going to teach you survival within around the area and what their environment is and what the surroundings are, what's available to them. Actual surviving is going into terrain that you are completely unfamiliar with. So how do you do that? That's what you need.
So in hindsight, if you were starting over again, is there anything you would have done differently ahead of time?
No, actually. No, I don't think so, except for had more time to prepare for it and walk around barefoot a lot longer. But everything else, I was completely prepared. I had completely changed my diet, which I've started again now. And I'll tell you, I'll elaborate on that in a little bit. I cut down on my food. And most people go like, why would you do that? You know, shouldn't you be trying to put on weight before you go out there? And I was like, well, no. There's a difference between putting on weight in order for it to burn while you're out there, but at the same time, you need to think very carefully what foods you are putting into your body. So basically, I go back to as nature as possible. I'll eat very rare meats. I'll eat a lot of salad with nothing on it. I keep everything very basic and simple because that's what you want your body to be prepared for. It's not going to get all the juicy fats and the carbs, the breads, the pasta, the pizza, you know, which is what a lot of people think that they should be doing.
So why are you doing that now again?
Well, I just got confirmed that I'm going to be doing another show.
For Naked and Afraid?
No, I can't release any further information than that, but I will say that it is going to be for 42 days.
Wow.
In the wilderness.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, I look forward to seeing that one.
And this time I will be by myself.
Wow.
I'll be alone. I won't be partnered up with anyone.
Okay.
There are others, but we are all being dropped in individually. And I think it's going to be more of like a documentary diary kind of thing over 42 days.
Well, but the way you're eating, in some ways, is probably not a bad way to be a healthy person anyway.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very strict with my diet anyways. I would say 95% paleo. I don't eat takeouts. I don't eat processed foods. I don't eat TV dinners. I'm very, very much a home-cooked basic foods, tasty basic foods, of course. But, yeah, I don't go out eating burgers or pizzas or anything of the sort. I like to keep my body clean and healthy. And preparation for these kind of things, it's about getting your body attuned to little or no food out there. So what you want to do is try and shrink your stomach a bit, because any bit of food that you do get to eat out there is going to fill you up. And your body gets used to that amount of food, therefore it metabolizes differently and it's not going to burn it off so fast.
Well, that's all for this episode of the Naturist Living Show. Thank you, as always, for listening. My name is Stéphane Deschaine, and I am your host for this podcast and the owner of Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park. You can find links to all of the items I mentioned in the show notes on the website at naturistliving.bearoaks, B-A-R-E, of course, bearoaks.ca, because we are in Canada. Please keep sending your comments and suggestions. I always appreciate reading them, even if I don't always have time to reply to them all. The show's email address is naturistliving, one word again, at bareoaks.ca, bareoaks.ca. But instead of sending an email, why don't you call and leave your comment, and then we can play it on the show. You can take as many tries as you want. You can even delete it if you're not happy afterwards. I'm not promising I will use all the comments because, you know, it has to be appropriate for our audience, but I will definitely listen to it and reply. The show's phone number is country code 1-905-473-6060, and then you dial extension 333 because it gets you into the Bear Oaks main voicemail. If you are in the U.S. and Canada, you can call toll-free at 1-888-373-9124. Once again, extension 333, and you can get into the same system through Skype. The Skype name is Bear Oaks, one word. And you will get the main voicemail system answering, and you dial extension 333 once again. Join us again in about a month for the next episode of the Naturist Living Show.
This episode of the Naturist Living Show was brought to you by Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park, traditional naturist values in a modern setting. Traditional values means that naturism is more than just taking your clothes off. It is a life philosophy with physical, psychological, environmental, social, and moral benefits. Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park strives to promote those naturist values in a modern setting that provides the amenities and services that our members and visitors expect. Free your body, free your mind. Learn more at www.bearoaks.ca.